So now it's time for the evening program, as was announced, and it's been done by our brother Mark O'Grady, and it's entitled Ephesus, Center of the Asian Ecclesiastes. I was going to say community. Ecclesia. Brother Mark.
Good. Well, tonight is actually much less formal. We're basically looking at some pictures, slides of the city of Ephesus. Has anyone here been to Ephesus? No? Okay, interesting. I'll tell you a little bit about the background. So what we're basically going to be doing is looking at the city of Ephesus and just getting a little bit of a feel for the layout of the city, and we'll appreciate then some of the ecclesial events that took place. Ephesus was an extremely significant location for our first century brothers and sisters. If you come with me, first of all, to Acts chapter 18, we have the first reference to Paul and Ephesus, and he called in very briefly. You may remember he had been at Corinth, and he found a spectacularly wonderful couple by the name of Priscilla and Aquila. And they traveled with him from Corinth, and on the end of his second missionary journey, he just popped into Ephesus very briefly on his way back to Antioch, and he left Priscilla and Aquila there. So we find that in chapter 18 of Acts, verse 19, he came to Ephesus and left them, that's Priscilla and Aquila from the previous verse, left them there, but he himself entered into the synagogue, reasoned with the Jews. When they asked him to stay, he said, "No, sorry, I'm going home." So he bade them farewell, saying, "I must keep this feast that cometh at Jerusalem." So he does that and heads back to Antioch. When we get to verse 23, we have the beginning of Paul's second missionary journey. In the meantime, back at Ephesus, Priscilla and Aquila find a man by the name of Apollos, and they convert Apollos. He was instructed in the baptism of John the Baptist, but they then taught him the gospel more fully, and he then departed to Corinth. By the time we get to chapter 19, on Paul's second missionary journey, he now comes back to Ephesus and he spends a longer time at Ephesus. Does anybody know how long Paul spent there, by the way? How long? Three years. Does anyone know how we can prove that? Brother Ryan is absolutely right. Excellent. Chapter 20. Remember the incident when he was traveling back and he didn't want to go to Ephesus, and he called the elders and they walked over and they met him, and he went through this final exhortation for them in Acts chapter 20 when he told them he would see their face no more. And if we just turn over to chapter 20, verse 31, "Therefore watch and remember that by the space of 3 years I ceased not to warn everyone night and day with tears." He was warning them of an apostasy that would come in. So when you think about it, 3 years is a very long time for the Apostle Paul to be based anywhere in his missionary journeys. So it actually became the center of the Asian ecclesias. Sometimes you hear it as being described as the Jerusalem for the Gentiles. That's not a biblical description, but it was certainly the center of proclamation work for John and became an extremely important center ecclesially. During his time there, it appears he made one or two side trips across to Macedonia. And probably, there is some dispute about that, but I believe it is probably the case that 1 Timothy was written during one of those side visits to the area of Macedonia. And so he left Timothy there and then wrote the epistle back. So Timothy spent a lot of time in the area of Ephesus and took particular personal responsibility for the development of the ecclesia there. We have the letter to the Ephesians, and of course in the letters to the seven ecclesias, in Revelation we have in chapter 2, begins with the letter to the ecclesia at Ephesus. So Ephesus is a very prominent location and a prominent place for the work of the truth. And all we're going to be doing tonight is really just getting a bit of a feel for the layout of the city of Ephesus, such as it is now. It'll give us a bit of an appreciation for our earlier brethren and some of the things that they experienced there. Now, how did we end up going to Ephesus? Well, it's a long story. It took me 20 years to persuade Sister Nari that it was safe to go to Israel. 20 years, literally. Maybe more. She finally relented. She no longer had little children at home. So she agreed, and I went and booked our flights to Israel on the 3rd of October. And on the 7th of October, Hamas invaded. And then I was trying to explain to Nari that it was still safe to go. I managed to persuade her that we shouldn't actually cancel the tickets. We agreed with our two daughters and their husbands that they would join us on this visit to Israel. So we had Amy and Louis and Hannah and Jacob booked to join us going to Israel. We kept our tickets and we decided that we would still go. Things had quietened down a little bit. We would just stay well away from the area of Gaza for some reason and well away from the northern boundary as well. That's fine. So we left home. We started the journey. We got as far as Scotland. And you may recall about April, May last year, Israel assassinated an Iranian general in the building next to the Iranian embassy in Syria. And the Iranians immediately responded with 300 drones and missiles straight into Israel. The world held its breath saying, the whole Israel and Iran are going to end up with a major war. Actually, what just happened a few months ago. It was expected last year. So immediately all the other airlines other than LL cancelled all their flights. New Zealand government put it travel advisory level 4, basically get out, stay out. And at that point we had to look at it and say, is it a good time to take our family there? Probably not. So we had to cancel our trip. We had 2 days notice and we would get our money back for the accommodation. It was a bit more of a struggle to get flights back. Some of us succeeded, some didn't. But we had 2 days, we cancelled it, and then we thought, well, now what are we going to do? There's six of us and we wanted to have this biblical tour, so we then, in a hurry, organised a tour to Turkey. So at least we'd get some biblical archaeology in. And we found a crowd called Ephesus Shuttles who run tours. And we managed to arrange at short notice a little package that included flights through from Istanbul, a tour guide, a van, a driver, and some accommodation and food around that area of the seven ecclesias. And so he took us to the area of the seven ecclesias. We only had 5 days, so it was a pretty tight tour. And that was a wonderful experience, actually, and really helped me come to appreciate the diversity of history of that area of Asia Minor. So that's basically what we're looking at now. Of the areas of the seven ecclesias, if you went to go and visit them, some of them, frankly, are not worth visiting. Philadelphia is one. Where you go to Philadelphia, what's there? Well, they've built a modern city on top of it. They did find an old broken-down church site from hundreds of years later. And every time they do some plumbing and they dig up a bit of broken marble, they stick it on that site. And that's where you go if you go to Philadelphia. Well, that's great, but it's not really that interesting. Some of the others, like Laodicea, were really interesting. Pergamos was quite an interesting place to go and visit as well, and so was Sardis. But the most impressive is actually the city of Ephesus. All right. Good. I think I'm going to master this. Okay, so it's very obvious where Turkey is. Istanbul, by the way, which sits on the European side, is well worth a visit. It's one of the most fascinating places I've ever visited. Bear in mind, I've never been to Israel. But it's the bridge, basically, between East and West, the Levant. And the history of Istanbul, from a biblical point of view, is fascinating. Yes, it's Turkey at the moment. But it was the head of the Byzantine Empire for 1,000 years, started by Constantine. When? AD 312, I think. And it's fascinating history. You go through to 1453, and the Turks took it off the remnant of the Byzantine Empire and set up their base. So it became the centre of the Ottoman Empire. So the Turks then ruled through this area. But if you go way back in history, the seven ecclesias were down in this area here, particularly in a particular valley. And the Apostle Paul travelled around some of those areas. So it has quite a long and interesting history. The empire of Alexander the Great was obviously based around the area of Greece and Macedonia. And the entrance of Grecian influence through into the area of Turkey happened after the Battle of Troy. you'll be familiar with the story of the Trojan horse. There seems to be argument as to whether it's myth or true history. Whether that's the case, Troy was sacked by the Greeks, and it opened up the opportunity for the Greeks to come through this area here. Some years later, of course, Alexander the Great came across here. The Persian Empire, from way back here in Iran, where am I, background here, had actually expanded right across this area, and the Persians and the Greeks fought each other a lot. Alexander's father had been involved in some of those skirmishes, and when Alexander took over the throne of his father Philip, one of the first things he did, and it was within a couple of years, having consolidated his power by killing a lot of his relatives, as they did in those days, he then crossed the Hellespont and went through this area here, attacked the Persian Empire in several famous battles, and then Grecian influence came through in this region here. Now, after Alexander died, biblical prophecy here, the empire was broken into how many parts? Four, okay, the four generals, who are the four wings or the four notable heads, the four notable horns. There's a whole series of prophecies in Daniel which talk about the division of his empire into four parts. One of those was a guy that I used to know as Lysimachus. I don't know how you call him here, Lysimachus. Well, in Turkey, Lysimachus. Ah, Brother Matt Palmer says, yes, that's much better. Okay, Lysimachus. It took us a few days to work out who Lysimachus was, and then we finally worked it out. So he was one of the generals. He ended up with an area around Macedonia, around here, or Thrace more, actually. But he came and conquered some of these areas, and he ended up in control of this region here. And he set up, Lysimachus set up, he worked in two particular cities, the city of Pergamos, or Pergamum, and the city of Ephesus. He apparently rebuilt the city of Ephesus in honour of his wife. Now, Lysimachus, as part of his campaigns, ended up extremely wealthy. He ended up with something like, and I've got some figures here, if I can find them, 9,000 talents of silver. So at 26 kgs per talent, about 900 tons of silver. That's what the guide said to us. I was not altogether certain about his maths. But be that as it may, he ended up with an extremely large reserve of silver that he had gained control of by winning the battle. So he stored that at Pergamon, and he put one of his generals in control of Pergamon and the treasury. And his general was called Philetaerus. The problem he made was he didn't select someone he could trust. So once Philetaerus was in control of this vast treasury of silver, he then rebelled. He joined together with the Seleucids. Lysimachus, nearly got that wrong, Lysimachus came to attack him, lost, died, and now Philetaerus sets up an empire of his own at Pergamon. And that became the beginning of the Pergamid Empire. So this is part of the thrashing around that happened after the death of Alexander the Great. Through the Pergamid dynasty, we come down to a man called Attalus III. And he decided that on his death, he would bequeath his kingdom to the Romans. And it's interesting when you hear people, some of them think he was mad. I mean, why would you do that? Why would you just give way to the Romans and bring the Romans in? Others say that he was an extremely bright and a man of foresight. And what he did was he stopped Rome from coming and destroying his empire. And it meant that Pergamon became quite an important city as far as the Romans were concerned. So there were two at that stage. There was Pergamon and Ephesus, and they sort of vied a bit. Then Pergamum fell out of favour with the Romans. It had to do with the building of a temple and whether they were given permission to build a temple for the Roman emperor, which was a great privilege apparently, and they were declined and they basically fell out over it. And so the Romans then put their emphasis on Ephesus. And Ephesus then grew to become the third largest city in the Roman Empire. It was the capital city of Asia, and so it basically became the capital of this whole region here. It was an extremely prominent city as far as the Romans were concerned, and we'll see evidence of that as we go through. The politics of it sounds remarkably like politics in most countries today, frankly. So Ephesus then becomes an extremely powerful and wealthy city. By the time we get to the Apostle Paul, we've now got a city which was built originally by Greeks, very strong Greek influence, and then a lot of Roman influence. Okay, enough of a history lesson. If we look here, Casadarsi is a city there, and Ephesus is just inland from there. Ephesus was one of three major ports in the continent itself. So we're now going to basically zoom in a little more. There is Casadarsi there. And we're going to have a look now at a satellite picture and just get a bit of a feel for this region around here in Turkey today. Okay, now that's a satellite picture. And you may not be able to see this from down here. Let me just see what it looks like. Oh, you can. There's a strange shape in the middle of that map, or that satellite picture. Can you see this? And it looks like it's got a long tail. Can you see that? That was the port of Ephesus. So that's where the coastline was through there in those days. And it silted up kilometres. And basically, over the course of a couple of hundred years, they kept dredging a channel. That's what the tail is. So from the satellite now, you can actually look down and you can see the old port of Ephesus and you can see where they dredged it. And after a while, it became a losing battle. Well, you can see that. That's the sea now. And so they abandoned the city. That filled up and it just became basically a mud swamp. And so it became a breeding ground for malaria. Do you know what the word malaria means? Why the Romans called it malaria? What? Sorry, bad air. Excellent. So, mal, bad or sick, malaria, bad air. And they actually believed that malaria came from having bad air. So when they had a malaria outbreak, they opened all the windows. If it's borne by mosquitoes, that's not smart. So they actually kept making it worse with their theories of health in those days. And by the way, if anyone has any comments or questions, just chip in because this is informal tonight and let's see how we go. Okay, so that's, they basically abandoned the city. Now what we're going to do now is hone in on this area above the port, which is the old city of Ephesus. So there's the port a little bit larger, and here are the ruins of old Ephesus. Now we came in I've just turned the torch on again, sorry. I think that's better. We came in from the top here and we started the upper city and we came down this area here down to the lower city and actually came out here. The temple of Artemis, or the temple of Diana, was, I haven't got it exactly right, but it's somewhere around this location. So it was part of that city. The city, by the way, was huge. Anybody have any idea of the population of Ephesus in those days? The estimates range, minimum, absolute minimum, of 250,000. 250,000. Some of the experts think it was up as high as 400,000. And the way they calculate that is by the theatre that we're going to have a look at shortly. Okay, let's zoom in a little bit more. So that's the city. As I say, we came in from the top here, and that's the upper city. You then go down through past the gates of Hercules, which I'll talk about, down through the middle city, and then the lower city itself. It's probably worth just spending a little bit of time talking about this. You can see the theatre. Now, that's the theatre where our brethren, Gaius and Aristarchus, were dragged. We're going to talk about that a little bit more shortly. Greek cities were based on a plan by a Greek town planner, apparently the first town planner in history. His name was Hippodamus, and he structured cities into an upper city, which was where the king and many of the temples were based, so the elite of the city and the rulers. The middle city, which was more administration, and then the lower city, which was the common people. This area has been excavated over about 150 years, but they reckon only somewhere between 10 to 15% of the city has actually been excavated. So these extraordinary ruins are just these central areas. So they were the more important public areas. The actual city itself basically covered an area right around here. In fact, further, probably up around up here as well. And so most of Ephesus has not yet been uncovered. They've just focused on the most important areas. So as you come through, this is the area where the government, the seat of government was, the gates of Hercules here, and there's a marble path which runs down here. There's the Celsus Library, there's the main agora, there's the main theatre, and then down the street here it went basically down to the port, which was sitting in this region here. So it was quite a well-structured city. Okay, looking down a little more detail, that's a small theatre, the Odeon. That's the area, the Bulletarian, where the Senate sat. That seated 1,600 people, and that's where basically all the matters of state for the Asian province were managed from. So it was the capital of Asia, so this was an extremely important area. Next to it was the Prytanean, which is the town hall, and the town hall and the Senate rooms always went side by side in those old Greek cities. They have a very structured approach, so whenever the archaeologists are excavating, they know exactly where to look. Once they find one, they look around until they find the other. And here's the state agora here, and there was a, and I'll talk about a little bit more about that as we go through. As you go down that path, you go past, this is a roof over some buildings they have excavated. We'll go inside those shortly. And there's a number of temples starting here that come down this area here. And there's the main agora. So the riot and the burning of the scrolls and the riot probably happened in this agora here. And then if you go a little further, there's the agora, and you can see where it relates to the theatre and the main street that ran down to the port. Okay, looking back the other way, here's the what's left of the port. Looking up the main street that goes from the port, there's the main theatre, and there are the various excavations as we come down. And as I say, the city basically ran all around this area here. It was massive. That's more what it looked like. Artist's impression based on the ruins that they've got. So quite a sizable city, as you can see. The main street that runs up from the port, the theatre, and so forth. Good. So starting at the top, that's looking down from the very top. And across to this area here, you can see the little curved seating there. That's the Senate, where the Senate would sit. And the town hall, Prytanean, is sitting just in behind here as we go through. That's it, just a little bit more as we go along. Okay, then you start walking down. So these ruins here are the end of the Bulletarian or the Senate House. It actually went across and the other side was here. It was quite a massive building. And I think I have, there's a couple of pillars of it. There's our guide. Interesting gentleman. Okay, as you go down, these things here are everywhere. Now they're clay pipes. They had running water through the whole city. They had three major aqueducts coming in. One of them was 7 kilometres, and one of them was as large as 32 kilometres. They brought water into the whole city. If we go to the next one, there's a pile of some of those pipes that they've put aside. You pay for the size of the pipes as a house owner. The smaller the pipe, the more you pay, because it meant the water pressure was greater. But they basically, anyone apart from the lower classes, people had running water, and the more wealthy actually had running water for toilets and things like that as well. Okay, you can see the street that basically runs down here as you start heading down. You'll get a bit of an appreciation of the size of it. That's the area of the Prytanean or town hall sitting here. There's the ruins of what it is there. Basically, when they abandoned the city, they did. They just walked out and left it. And then people came and used it as a quarry, and they took all the marble away. Not all, but quite a bit of it. And then it just filled up. So, you know, walls fell down and roofs fell in over time, but it just filled up. And when the archaeologists came along, they simply shifted about 8 to 9 metres of soil and found the city underneath. So you can now walk on the streets where the Apostle Paul and Timothy would have walked. Now that gives you a bit of a feel for what it was like. So that's where the Senate sat in there. That's that small curved theatre. Here's the Prytanean. There's the town hall up there. Sorry, the Bulaterian, and the town hall is here. And these buildings would always go together in a Greek city. So you can imagine this is a really sophisticated city that our brothers and sisters were having to live in. You can see the path heads down here. We're just going to go where Louis is at the moment. We're going to go and have a quick look over there and see the Temple of Domitian. That's what's left of the Temple of Domitian now, this area through to here. If I just go back a touch, go back one, you might see there's some stairs that go up here between these archways. If you overlay the building over it, that's what it looked like. Now Domitian, and I hadn't realized this, Domitian, so we had Vespasian who came up against Jerusalem, started the process, was called away to become emperor, left Titus to take over and finish the destruction of Jerusalem, which he did. Titolatus built the Titus Arch in Rome. He succeeded from Vespasian and became emperor. It was when he died that another relative, and I think it might have been a younger brother, but Domitian took over. He was crazy. He wanted to surpass the others. So he started passing enormous laws around taxes. He was the one that began quite a persecution of the Christians in his day. And the Romans had begun a cult of emperor worship, so that when the emperor died, he could then be worshipped as a god. And you'd then build temples for the emperor as a god. It's all linked to politics, because what would happen is if you were his son and you could have the people worship your father as a god, well, what did that mean about you? So it was simply a power-based thing. Well, Domitian wanted to be worshipped while he was still alive. He got so crazed with it that the Senate had him assassinated. And then they have a particular phrase, they deleted his name from all of these buildings that he had made. Okay, so we're now going to head onto this path which runs down. That's just looking back the other way. Okay, and there's the path. You notice that? It's marble. So the original marble road heads down here and it broadens out past this little bit here. And that was a major shopping street called Curetes, Curetes. And it was one of the major shopping areas in the city itself. So you can walk down there. Now this is extremely slippery. So they have signs everywhere and they tell everyone to be extremely careful because these flagstones have been polished by many, many feet over a long period of time. And we saw several people slip over and there were ambulances that wait at the bottom of the hill to pick people up. And apparently they make some good money out of tourists who don't listen, slip over, break their leg and then have to pay to get taken off to hospital. Okay, they did have, in the old days, some ways of stopping it from being as slippery. See what that is? Brother Matt, you should be interested in that. This is health and safety. They've actually cut grooves in the marble to try and get some grip so that people in the old days didn't slip and fall on it. Okay, so that's looking down Curetes Street. You can see the size of it and the shops either side of it. And you can actually see, as we will shortly, some of the mosaics going through that area. So that's some of the shops off to the side of the street. And you can see the floors that are there. So it's actually a remarkably well-preserved city. And probably our brethren would have been buying products in these cities. Where they had doors into the main street, it was a shop. If a door went out to the side, it was a warehouse. Okay, I'm going to flick through these reasonably quickly as we're walking down. Down the end is the Celsus Library. But that's a reproduction of what the street would have looked like in the days when our brothers and sisters were walking up and down in the city of Ephesus. And I quite liked thinking about Timothy walking through some of these streets, or Aquila and Priscilla, or Apollos when he was first converted. So there's a lot of ecclesial history that was in this city. The goddess Nike and the gates of Hercules. Hercules was a Greek hero who was set, hopefully your Greek mythology is better than me, is it 12 tasks he was set? Or 10? I think it was 12 that he was set, one of which was to kill a lion. So when Hercules is depicted, he did killing a lion. In those days, only 2% of the population could read and write. About 5% of the population could read. So if you wanted to brainwash people, you couldn't do it with written material. And so they used sculpture for crowd control and for populace control. So if you went from the lower city up to the upper city, you had to go through the gates of Hercules. And Hercules was depicted there killing a lion. And the subliminal message as you go through is the people on the other side of this gate are powerful. They are in connection with the gods because the temples are on the other side of this gate. And so if I go through that gate, I need to be careful or else I'll be killed like Hercules killed the lion. There's all sorts of subliminal messages in the structure of these places. The Fountain of Trajan, as you go down, so obviously you're talking here about something that's, I forget exactly when Trajan was. Some of the bigger temples here were built after the time of the Apostle Paul. This area here is our guy just explaining the wording there, and the word Trajan, the name Trajan, is actually found in Greek letters there. And that's what it looked like originally. So quite a spectacular building originally. As you go down that hill, there are streets that go off to the sides. So the common people, well not common, but other people lived, and these streets just went up the hillsides, and there were streets and houses all over those hillsides. And you can see some of those were quite splendid side streets. Okay, you come down to the end of that area, there's the path goes down to the Celsus Library. Oh, on the way down, I mentioned this place that's covered here. We didn't get inside it, but this is what's inside it. These are some of the more wealthy apartments for those who lived in the city. Actually surprisingly well preserved when you think that it's 2,000 years ago. So that's a reproduction of what they look like. So extraordinary wealth in some of those places. That's a frieze, and I forget which building that was taken off. It's sitting in the Ephesus Museum. The Temple of Hadrian on the way down. You can see how a lot of these temples were based around the Roman emperors, and you can see how they're trying to assert their dominance and their authority. As you go through here, the baths were off to one side from here. The Roman baths were quite a sophisticated setup. They had four different rooms. No guessing, no prizes for guessing. The Frigidarium was cold, and the Caldarium was hot, and the Tepidarium was tepid or lukewarm. They were four different rooms that they used for the baths. Does anybody know what that is? Latrine, that's a nice polite word for it. Excellent. The restrooms, I think I should say, if I'm in North America. So that's a public toilet. But when we say public toilet, it was only wealthy people that were allowed to use these. They were marble. If you were going to use it, you'd go down there, and it was actually males only in here, and this is where they would discuss business matters, affairs of state, all sorts of things. It was a social gathering place. Now, can you imagine what it would be like sitting on marble in the middle of winter? So you sent your slave down first, and he sat on it to warm it up. And then you came down and sat on it. And apparently it was a great social gathering place. Full running water under here, by the way, permanent running water. They didn't have toilet paper, so they had a brush with a sponge, which sat in a vinegar pot, but there was running water here that you could clean the sponge out as well. So, you know, they were advanced, but may not have smelt quite like we smell. I'll just put it that way. The common people didn't have access to this. They just used clay pots. And the liquid afterwards was used for things like tanning, washing, physical washing, and all sorts of things. So an interesting version of recycling. Some of the houses, and I don't have a photo here, but some of the houses had underfloor heating, quite sophisticated. And you could see the little pillars that the floor was based on, and they had heated water running under their stone floors to warm the stone floor up. So their houses had hot water central heating. We're talking about extraordinary wealth in this city. Now we're coming to some of the larger private houses. See these, it looks like it's got smallpox on the walls. So they had individual rooms, one for the dining, one for a library, one for sleeping, and they had a whole series of different rooms. And if you wanted to change the decor, you put more plaster on. So you then chip a hole in the wall and then put another layer of plaster on. So those little holes in the wall are where they put a little indentation so the next layer of plaster would stick on. And they did fresco, so you paint it while it's wet. You then paint the decorations, get an artist to paint your room. So you could change the decor if you decided you didn't like it. These gaps here, the higher ones are for, and I think the next photo might show it a bit more clearly, the higher ones, these holes here, are actually where wooden beams were for upper floors. The lower ones were for air ventilation for these houses. I was talking to the teens. This guide, he was a bit of an interesting fellow. He was more used to having a tour bus of 50 people. So he'd arrive at a place and he'd stand up on a stone and he'd just sort of launch out with a stream of information. It was very informative and it was like drinking from a fire hose. You'd try and write it all down. But if you tried to stop him midstream, he'd sort of blink and look at you and then carry on. So you had to wait until he'd done his thing and then ask him various questions. But one of the things that I really struggled with, I was talking to the teens about this, is he was telling us about the fact that with the language that was used in the day, they had no wavels. No wavels. And he kept saying, oh, in those days there were no wavels. A wavel, what's that? Is that some sort of small animal? I mean, would it bite? What's a wavel? And he kept saying, there were no wavels. And then suddenly the penny dropped. You know how in some languages a W is pronounced as a V? And other languages a V is pronounced as a W? Take the word wavels and change out W to a V and a V to a W. What have you got? Vowels. So he was telling us there were no vowels. Once we had worked it out, of course, every time he talked about wavels, it was all that Louis and Jacob could do not to burst out laughing. Okay, this library, the Library of Celsus, is after the time of the Apostle Paul. They like to claim it's built on the site of the school of Tyrannus. Why? Oh, because they'd build buildings on a site where something to do with education had been, so maybe the school... Yeah, right, whatever. But it's quite an impressive building. And in there they had 12,000 scrolls. It was the third largest library in the world after Alexandria and Pergamon Library. And can you see what that is? A little bit of graffiti here carved into one of the steps. It's a menorah. So there's evidence of the Jews and Jewish influence in the city, and some of it carved into the stone of the steps of this library. As you go through the gates from the library, here's the main agora. So this is where the scrolls were probably burnt, and this is probably where Demetrius started the riot. You know, Demetrius is described as a silversmith, excuse me, and it says he called together the craftsmen. So he was probably the head of the guild, because it's the head of the guild that had the power to call an assembly of the guild. And they were extremely influential men, not only in their guild, but in the city as well. And they set the rules and the laws around how their individual guilds operate. So there's the agora. Now this main agora, it had 88 shops around it. So there were 22 shops down each side of the agora. It's a massive, massive area. Probably the Apostle Paul plied his trade in one of those shop areas. The suggestion was made to us that as a tent maker, he was familiar with working with leather and wool in particular, and that a lot of his clientele base may have been legionnaires or the legions, the Roman legions, and that also a major demand for those skills were sails, ship sails. And they just made the observation that it would have made it easier for the Apostle Paul to get ship voyages around the Mediterranean, because your tools of trade were quite easy to pack and take with you. And I thought that was quite an interesting observation when you hear about them taking ship and sailing. Okay, we're heading now through the right-hand end of the agora and through on the area up towards this remarkable theatre. As you go up, can you see all the lines that are just sort of carved here? These are chariot lines that have been carved in the marble flooring on that street heading up to the theatre. So it just gives you an impression of how much traffic was in that area. And there is the theatre itself. Now, nothing can really prepare you for the sheer size of that theatre. When they built it, the lower parts were marble, the upper parts, when they extended it, when the Romans rebuilt it, was in granite. They actually built archways sitting in here and down this side here, so they made artificial hill coming around to enlarge the size of it. And it could seat 25,000 people. So on the basic rule that the theatre, and it was a Greek rule for Greek construction of cities, the theatre had to be able to seat 10% of the populace. So there's a minimum of 250,000. But if that didn't include women and slaves, then the population could have been as high as 400,000. What I found incredible, well, that's standing on the, basically where the stage would have been. So standing on this area here, looking up, that's what it looks like. There's Louis, he's on his way down. Louis had gone up, he hadn't gone to the very top, he'd gone to this layer up here. And Jacob and I were down here conversing, and Louis could hear everything we were saying up at that level. So the acoustics of these theatres was just incredible. Now, what I found very moving, oh, that's Louis coming down, slightly larger. That's what it would have looked like back in those days. Now, what I found very moving was standing basically in this area here, looking up at that scene. Now, bear in mind, the riot started down in the Agora, and they rushed to the theatre. This is where they rushed. They took Gaius and Aristarchus, two of the brethren, and had them in front of the crowd. So you imagine being Gaius or Aristarchus, and you're standing here, and all around you is 25,000 people screaming out, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians," for the space of a couple of hours. And our brethren stood there facing that. And as I stood there and I looked up, I could imagine that hillside just full of 25,000 people baying for blood. Incredibly daunting. The Apostle Paul was off to one side, and he tried to run in to be with his brethren, and the brethren stopped him. It's just as well. The suggestion is that the crowd had got hold of Gaius and Aristarchus. They were after Paul, and they were using him as bait. And the brethren stopped the apostle from rushing in there to stand alongside his brethren. And you suddenly start to appreciate what it was that our brethren went through. Just enormous things. Then the Jews put forward one Alexander. And he was trying to address the people. When the people heard he was a Jew, they screamed out, "Yet even more great is Diana of the Ephesians." In the end, the town clerk, when he finally quieted them down, it took a long time, said, "Hey, what you should have done is send Paul up to the court, which was further up in the administration area, and have him put up before the judiciary rather than having this sort of a riot." But really dramatic, and I actually found it quite moving to stand there and just imagine our brethren experiencing that in that particular location. It really does bring it to life. It was really quite something. I mean, that gives you just a perspective of the sheer size of it. And you can imagine that just full of people screaming for hours. Here's the main road back down to the port, and we're not far off finished now. That's it, heading down to the port area. Oh, that's just a couple of, there's a model in the museum of what the Temple of Artemis, the Temple of Diana of the Ephesians, would have looked like. It was, just in terms of size, I've got it here somewhere, 20 metres high, so what's that, about 65 feet high, the columns and the ceiling, 127 columns, it was 120 metres by 60 metres, it's the largest pagan temple ever in history, they claim. So it was huge, absolutely huge. That's what the Turks claim. I don't know, maybe some of the ones in South America they've been uncovering might be large, but I don't know. It was absolutely enormous. It was funded by Croesus, the extremely wealthy king. That's just a few pictures of it. And then there's a couple of statues of Diana which they have uncovered, one of which was up near the Senate House. I won't go through the details there, apart from simply to say she had a head on her city as the protector of the city of Ephesus. That's all that remains of the Temple of Diana now. Right, what I might just do is I'm going to take this off, and I have a short clip. And apparently the technology here is that when we go to this,
cities founded by Greek settlers in Asia Minor around the 10th century before Jesus Christ. In this area, the Aegean Sea occupied 8 kilometers of the current land, reaching a prosperous city blessed by its goddess
Oh, it's looking fine here.
I was thoroughly enjoying it.
That's interesting. I wonder. Right, I'm just going to stop that and we'll try again. Did you get any of it at all? Or was I... It's not coming through, is it? Okay, I'm not sure how to fix that. So what I'm going to suggest we do is we close, and then I'll play around and see if we can get it going for anyone that wants to have a look at it. And if we can't get it going on the screen, I will put my laptop here, and the hardy few who want to see it can come down and have a look at it on the laptop. Okay? Thanks, Brother Matt.